Hello everyone and welcome to this week's episode of Boat Briefing. My name is Stuart Campbell, Editor-in-Chief of Boat International, and here to help me navigate through all the news from the world of superyachting is Sophia Wilson, our Acting Deputy Editor. Sophia, good to be back.
Good to be back in the office, back together again. We've kind of seemed to be getting better at this dual podcasting thing, mainly thanks to our producer Grace rather than any thanks to us.
No, absolutely. We were no use whatsoever. It's all Grace is doing. So thank you, Grace, on behalf of the whole podcast team. So we're back. We didn't record a podcast last week because we were all in Monaco. A lot of us were in Monaco for the Explore Yacht Summit, which we'll get to in a minute. But we did forget to flag the fact on the previous week's podcast that we would be missing a week. So apologies if you were waiting with bated breath for last week's podcast. We'll try and make up for it this week. So Sophia, why don't you tell us first of all about this week's interviewee?
Yeah, so this week our features director Charlotte caught up with the super yacht finance specialist Lisa Verbit. She's worked for the Bank of America since 1984, and she gave Charlotte some really interesting insights into how people choose to pay for their yachts. This included why some people who can afford to pay cash choose to take out a loan, how you can use your yachts to free up cash when you need it, and of course when issues arise when you have a yacht loan, but then the bill drags on or something else goes wrong. She also gave her take on how well the industry is doing, especially over in the States, which is obviously her kind of domain. She's seeing a lot of first-time owners since the pandemic, and she reckons the industry's never been in such a strong position. It's a really interesting insight into the world of superyacht finance, so make sure you don't miss that once Stuart and I have gone through all the other news and what we've been up to.
So Lisa's been in this game since 84, and this is the best time she's ever, the best time the industry's ever had, basically, in her view. Wow. I mean, that is saying something. I was at Vandervolk, the Vandervolk shipyard, just, and I was talking to those guys. And it's interesting when you talk to some of the shipyards, they are very, very happy, but they're also, there are little flags of alarm around inflationary pressures, particularly, especially in the semi-custom and slightly more series production ranges where yards like to have fixed prices. And obviously, margins are getting squeezed constantly by rising raw material costs. So that's just something to keep an eye on in the future, I think. We make mention of that as well in our global order book report that's going into the January issue. But still, I mean, despite that, for Lisa, someone of Lisa's expertise and experience to say that is quite something.
Yeah, I guess since kind of what happened in 2008, I think the whole industry is maybe a little bit more cautious when things are good about just how good things are when they're good, which is probably a positive.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I was around in the industry back then, and I think anyone who experienced 2007 to 2009, and you know, slightly bitter winds that followed, good times are great, but they're always taken. You know, it's never a bad idea to apply a bit of caution to the good times as well. And I think I think the industry's learned that lesson. I certainly hope so. Anyway, so let's talk about the Explore Yacht Summit. Sophia, what were some of your highlights from last week's event?
Well, I mean, I think the main highlight, I feel like we've said it before with the World Superyacht Awards and Monaco Yacht Show, it's just great all being back together, all being in the same room, having that buzz. It was really busy. I had four panels during the day, so I was quite busy personally as well. A huge thank you, personal thank you from me as well to all the speakers who joined me on my panels. Everyone was brilliant and so insightful about the different parts of the industry that they're involved with. I think something that really stuck with me was that there was a sort of theme of sustainability that ran throughout the day, and how important this is going to be to the next generation of your owners coming through, and even the generation behind that as well. We hadn't really planned for that when we were putting the program together. We did have a panel called Leave No Trace, which was kind of deliberately designed to talk about this, but it kind of fed into everything throughout the day. You know, every different panel, whether it was looking at what kit you have on yachts, or whether it was looking at what Explorer yachts are in build, or the data behind it, it kind of had this theme that flowed throughout the day, and that it's great to see that, and that is becoming an increasingly important part of the industry. And as part of that, the other thing that kind of stuck with me is that owners wanting more and more meaningful experiences, be that inviting scientists on board. We had a representative for Yachts for Science there, which was great, and she spoke about some of the projects that are available. I'm sure we've spoken about it on the podcast before, but just to quickly recap, Yachts for Science is a kind of Tinder for scientists and yacht owners. So, you know, if you're going somewhere with your yacht and you want to add something to your experience there, there's lots of scientists that are looking for time on board in specific reasons, and Yachts for Science can help match that up. And then finishing the day, we had the owner of Asteria, and he was speaking about his adventures with his children and just what an amazing platform yachts can provide for that next generation. His 8-year-old son now wants to be a marine biologist, is obsessed with sharks. Made me feel like a pretty terrible parent personally, but it does show what an amazing, you know, what an amazing platform they can provide for the next generation. And I thought that was really inspiring.
I mean, how could you not be raising your kids on a 50-meter yacht Sophia? If that's your benchmark for terrible parenthood, then we're all failures. But yeah, some of the pictures he had up on screen were amazing. Him and the family adventuring around the world. I mean, what a way to raise your kids. Just phenomenal. But yeah, you're right. The thread, it wasn't deliberate, but it was absolutely a thread that ran throughout everything and almost every conversation at the moment, really. It's unavoidable, which is ultimately a very good thing, obviously. But the whole day was bookended with superyacht owners. So it kicked off with the owner of the 50-meter Perini Almira 2, who in the next couple of years with his wife is going to set off around the world. Part of that whole experience was he's setting out. He will measure his impact. His carbon impact and also his impact on local communities he meets along the way throughout the entire trip. It's kind of taking that applying the sustainable lens to every single thing he's doing as he goes around the world, which is a really interesting approach. Instead of being a reactive, it's a proactive exercise. Throughout the day, really, it was unavoidable. I really enjoyed, apart from the owners, obviously they're always great because everyone wants to hear from, you know, the end users about what they're doing, how they use their boats, you know, what can the companies learn from these owners' experiences. So we had, if you're familiar with the podcast, a couple of episodes ago, I interviewed two professors from the University of Monaco, Klaus and Annalisa. And they were great because, again, you know, they're outside the industry, so they don't have to be guarded about what they say. They can kind of speak truth to the industry. And often in this, you know, it's a very small business, the superyacht business, so people are often afraid to really speak their minds and, you know, ruffle feathers. But these guys weren't. And they basically stood in front of the room and said, you know what, you guys think you're doing a great job, but, you know, according to the 100 or more superyacht owners we interviewed, that's not always the case. And I thought the thing they related it to was really interesting. They say, well, often we think ultra high net worth users engage with the superyacht industry in isolation, but of course they don't. I mean, they're engaging with private jet companies, with watch manufacturers, with car manufacturers, et cetera, et cetera. They have lots of these other luxury markets they dip into. And almost universally in the feedback, they said their experiences in the superyacht industry weren't as good as those experiences in those other luxury industries, which I thought was fascinating, actually, because I hadn't really considered it from that point of view before. And I think a lot of people in the room kind of stood up and took notice.
And as you say, they were quite direct in that they sort of said, as a broker, you shouldn't be just comparing yourself to other brokers or brokerage houses. And as a builder, you shouldn't just be comparing yourself to other yards. And I think, you know, I agree, sometimes in industry, and we're probably even guilty doing it, being in the superyacht media, you look at your competitors within that little bubble rather than actually thinking further afield and thinking, as you say, what the end client is used to dealing with. And the end client certainly doesn't just exist in the superyacht industry.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So, I mean, if you weren't at the event, you can dig back through the archives of the podcast and you can listen to those, to Klaus and Annalisa speak very candidly on much the same subject in the podcast. But I do recommend it. It's a really good listen. And you had four panels. I had the two. So you literally did twice as much work as me on the day. So thank you very much, Sophia. You really did a shift. The other one I had was the Steve Monk and Secretary General of the International Hydrographic Office were there talking about crowdsourced bathymetry and why boats going off the beaten track can't always rely on the official charts that are respected by flag states, because often they're wildly out of date. Even if there is charting information or, you know, depth information on these charts, it's either out of date or it doesn't exist, basically. And even off big shipping routes, or even off Monaco, he said, you know, there were lack of sufficient information on the official charts. So, and again, I spoke to Steve and a colleague of his on the crowdsourced bathymetry working group, Jennifer Jenks, who spoke to us in a previous podcast about the challenges of gathering bathymetric data. Again, really interesting. And it was quite challenging for the room again, because, you know, it's just something people do not consider. So it was great to be able to introduce that subject to everyone as well.
Yeah, I know. It's a hot topic of yours, having spoken to them on the podcast.
Yeah, it really is. I can't stop talking about it.
It's catching up with catamarans at a rate.
Yeah, yeah.
You didn't squeeze in any catamarans, though, during the day. Disappointing.
No. Because I think we were going to talk about, I think they're going to come up at the Super Yacht Design Festival. So I thought it might be a bit overkill to jam them into the Explorer Yacht Summit as well.
Anyway, as well as being in Monaco for the Explorer Yacht Summit, you've also managed to fit in a trip to Amsterdam to attend Metz. I know there was a lot of uncertainty beforehand as to where the event was going to go ahead. We were all kind of checking our phones in Monaco as to whether Amsterdam was going into a lockdown. It wasn't going into a lockdown, a partial lockdown. The event did go ahead. How was it?
It was my first time ever in Metz, and I really liked it, actually. It was, yeah, you're right. So everyone was on tenterhooks leading up to it, because there was this announcement by the Dutch government that they were introducing these new restrictions. But the event escaped those, and it was great. I mean, apart from, everyone told me it was much smaller than previous years. I had no basis of comparison, obviously, but everyone said it was much smaller. And there were clearly some exhibitors who didn't show, because they were kind of, you know, areas where stands had almost been set up, but there was no one on them because the exhibitor had decided not to come to Amsterdam. But still, it felt busy to me, especially in the superyacht section, which was great. And I think I just went because after being locked up for so long, I'm just trying to express myself by going to every single event I can. And it's, you know, again, it's just great to be with so many people. And, you know, there was an 8 p.m. curfew, which did put a slight dampener on the social activities in the evening. But on the other hand, I woke up clear-headed every morning. So
it must be a real novelty for you, Stuart.
I was in bed by 9:30 every night. I mean, I've never known anything quite like it. But it was great. I really enjoyed it. And then I think that's it for a couple of weeks. And the next Travels Design Festival, isn't it? The beginning of December. That's the next one.
Yes, it is. Not many weeks away, but tickets are still available. I know we've spoken about it quite a lot over the past few weeks, but there is a brilliant lineup across from people within the industry as well as people outside the industry. We're working furiously to pull the final version of the programme together, but make sure you visit the Boat International website and don't miss the opportunity to buy tickets.
Yeah, it's going to be brilliant. So we've got one of the highlights is that so Mike Glazouridis is the owner of 80 meter Nobbeskroeg Superyacht Artifact, you know, just one of the most advanced and remarkable vessels ever built, will be there on stage, and I'll be up there with him just having a chat about the project, really, how it came to be, how he envisioned it, because obviously Mike is a technology entrepreneur, very well known. He's a good Google, Mike. You can read a lot about him, and fascinating individual, you know, beyond smart. And he talks with a level of detail about the systems on that boat. I just find myself nodding and hoping I don't look too stupid, because his knowledge is far in advance of mine about these systems, and he's brilliant. So that'll be great to get him on stage and try and encourage a few conversations in the room about how we can start building the next generation of superyachts. So before we get to the news this week, something else has happened since the last time we recorded. Sophia, what was that?
The December issue is now on sale. You have been in the office enough to ensure that's gone to press in between your networking engagements. It's a great issue, so make sure you don't miss it. It's got the gift guide, the Christmas quiz, which is definitely quite challenging one for the super yacht geeks amongst our listeners. So make sure you try your hand at that. It's also got the private aviation special. We've got the Heesen Arcadia on the cover, which looks fantastic. A big piece on the best super yacht cities to visit. Stuart, you keep on trying to explain to me the headline of that piece and how it relates to a song and how I say it wrong.
What was the headline again?
Yacht in the City.
Hot in the City.
I don't know.
I mean, obviously, you're a millennial, so before your time. But Hot, I think we'll go back to the desk and we'll put Hot in the City on Spotify as soon as we get back to our desks.
Yeah, continue my education. It's also our owner's profile this month is with Dr. Al Bawani, who I spoke to at Monaco Yacht Show, and he's really interesting, both about kind of what he does with owning Ocean Co. and Turquoise, but also how he enjoys yachting privately, and again, how he uses his yacht for time with his family. So yeah, lots to discover in that, as well as testing your vintage music knowledge.
Billy Idol, Hot in the City. Great track. Anyway, let's move on with the news. Why don't you introduce the first story, Sophia?
Yeah, so I'll kick us off with the news that Lursen has delivered 55-meter superyacht Moonsand. Designed by Bannenberg and Raoul, Moonsand is described as truly bespoke, with distinctive lines influenced by the 1973 Lursen superyacht Carinthia VI. Now, Lursen's obviously normally known for building the largest yachts in the world, but they're using this yacht to re-establish themselves in the 55 to 75-meter bracket. Moonsand is the smallest yacht launched by the yard since 1955, which is an incredible statistic. She's now in London, and Stuart, I believe you've been invited on board sometime in the next few weeks.
Yeah. Hopefully having a little peek on board next week. I can't wait, actually. Great looking boat, designed by Bannenberg and Raoul. And Dickie and Simon are just fantastic. So it'd be great to see them on board, and hopefully sneak Claire, our social media manager, on board as well, so we can get some pics for you. But yeah, great looking boat, and on the Thames, isn't it great when a superyacht is on the Thames? I love that. Kismet was here recently, wasn't it? So every couple of months, you know, big boat appears, and it kind of stops traffic. Really, it's fantastic. And Moonsand is definitely one of those. So looking forward to having a look on board her. Next up, the Fedship Explorer Shinkai has been spotted on sea trials. The 55-meter custom explorer has been in the North Sea after leaving the shipyard's Ellesmere facility earlier this month. Scheduled for delivery early next year, Shinkai is designed for embarking on grueling adventures such as the Northwest and even Northeast passages, and features a steel ice class hull and an advanced sonar system for exploring the ocean floor. I hope the owner of Shinkai will be contributing to the crowdsourced bathymetry effort. Previously known as Project 708, Shinkai was designed by Philip Briand, Philip Briand's Vitruvius Design Studio, and has an interior by Daniel Bootson of Bootson Design. So great looking boat, Shinkai. A Northeast passage, I mean, that is the next frontier, isn't it, really? I mean, I don't want to say the Northwest Passage is old hat, because it's absolutely not.
Basically just the Med now, the Northwest Passage.
I mean, you can still count kind of the number of boats that have actually gone through, only numbers in the hundreds. But it feels like the Northeast Passage would be a really cool thing to do. Definitely bucket list stuff, that. What's next?
Next is that Admiral is preparing to launch its flagship yacht, 75-meter Kensho. We're waiting, actually, for confirmation from the yard, but we are aware that it's either already been launched or is about to be launched. It's quite a secretive project, but it's rumoured to have an extensive use of glass in the superstructure and exceptional heights in the interior. And she will, of course, be the largest yacht ever delivered by Admiral. But she won't stay as the flagship for long, as they recently announced that they've got 100-meter in build, but that's not scheduled for delivery until 2025. Have a trivia question for you, Stuart. Which yacht was Admiral's flagship prior to the launch of Kensho?
I'm going to go with Planet Nine.
Correct. 73.2 metres.
And I didn't even need the hint in the script. Planet Nine, yeah. Actually, we talked about Planet Nine a lot as well. There's a great feature in the January issue that I've just read, actually, about superyachts in movies. And there's quite a bit about Planet Nine, because she was, of course, in Tenet.
Was she?
I've not seen Tenet, actually.
No, neither.
My tolerance for movie watching is, I get to, after the kids are put in bed, I have about half an hour before I fall asleep on the sofa, so...
Yeah, I imagine you're very up on Paw Patrol's latest.
Lots of Paw Patrol.
Yeah. Succession even is almost too long for me now. I'm like halfway through. Come on. Anyway. Next up, we got 115-meter Lursen Superyacht Project Enzo has been named Afo ahead of her delivery. The name, which is understood to mean grandmother in Mandarin. Understood to mean. I'm sure we can just put that in Google Translate and find out if Afo really does mean grandmother. I claim to speak a bit of Mandarin. I was there for a year in my youth.
I've forgotten about this. This is one of your weird.
I still retain a
few keywords. Peugeot, beer, of course.
Obviously.
Yeah. That may be
boat.
I can't remember what a boat was. Anyway,
my Mandarin's terrible. Anyway, the name, which is understood to mean grandmother in Mandarin, was officially unveiled at the shipyard. It is also now known that the yacht is registered with a Cayman Islands flag. It comes after the yacht completed sea trials in the North Sea earlier this month, and AFO first hit the water in June 2021. She was sold by a Moran Yacht and Ship in September 2018 to a repeat Lursen client who previously owned an 86-metre designed by Nouvelari Leonard. The 5,000 gross ton yacht is described as family focused, with various sports and leisure facilities on board, including an extra large gym in the Sky Lounge and wellness area on the lower deck. Next up, we have 59-meter classic Marala has left her shed at Pendennis. Built in steel by Camper Nicholson's in 1931, Marala arrived at the shipyard's Falmouth facility in August 2019 to undergo a rigorous program of work. And I saw her actually when she was kind of back to bare steel. And at that stage, you kind of think, wow, how is this ever going to be a yacht again? Because it was in quite a state. But, you know, Pendennis are masters of what they do. The boat's refloating marks the beginning of the final phase of construction, and the vessel will be moved to the shipyard's wet basin facility for completion ahead of sea trials and delivery in spring 2022. Speaking about the conversion, Morales' captain said the extensive structural work and paintworks undertaken has been a major part of the project for the owners. Their passion for the yacht and this restoration project has been driven by their desire to preserve and secure Morales' pedigree for both themselves and future generations of classic yacht enthusiasts. And that's a sentiment you hear for a lot of classic yacht owners. They do it out of a sense of heritage as well and preservation. And, you know, it's not just for their use. It's, you know, they're securing the future of this yacht for the next 100 or so years, and that's certainly the case with Marala. She'll be beautiful when finished, I'm sure, and I can't wait to see her myself.
So finally, we thought we should end the news by just highlighting another couple of big brokerage sales that have been announced this week. On Monday, it was announced that 70.71-metre Lursen Scat had been sold, with both the buyer and seller represented by Stuart Larson at Fraser. This is the 13th sale that Larson's been involved with this year, including Octopus, of course. So I'm imagining it's going to be a very jolly Christmas down the Larson household.
I keep waiting for the news that Stuart Larson has commissioned his own CPR. I'm sure it's not far away.
And then hot on the heels on that, on Tuesday, Ocean Independence announced that they'd sold 71.99-metre CRN motor yacht Azteca. What makes this sale more remarkable is that the yacht has actually been on the market less than 3 months, which is just showing how quickly things are moving at the moment. We're obviously going to have to wait another few weeks to see what happens with our champagne bet, Stuart. I actually did go back just to verify the numbers that we said. You said 650 sales total by the end of the year, and I said 640. But the way things are looking, I think the champagne might be on me at the moment.
What's the number now?
I'm not sure. I mean, we did it. We made that at the end of Q3 numbers.
Yeah.
We'll have to ask Raphael.
Yeah.
We'll have to get him to give us weekly updates.
Okay. Yeah, but Azteca, actually, she was priced. She was accepting Bitcoin as well, wasn't she? But we don't know what currency, crypto or otherwise, she was finally sold in. But again, you know, just the fact that a 72-meter boat sold in 3 months. I mean, wow. I mean, that's usually a 2-year project, and that's done in 3 months. Amazing. Well, congratulations to everybody involved in that deal. Let's move on to the data story. So brought to you by Boat Pro, as ever, the superyacht industry's leading market intelligence platform. Sophia, kick us off.
So as Stuart and some of the team have been at METS this week, we thought it seemed like a good opportunity to focus on the superyacht fleet built in the Netherlands. The Netherlands, of course, are home to some of the most prestigious shipyards, including Fedship, Oceanco, Amels and Royal Huisman. The fleet is made up of 949 superyachts, so approaching the 1,000 superyacht mark, making up 8.1% of the total global fleet. 66% of that is full custom yachts, which tends to mean larger yachts, and this can be seen with the average length overall, which is at 42.8 metres. The largest dark superyachts are 110-metre Oceanco Chaos, ex-Jubilee, and the 110-metre Fedship Anna. In 2022, though, those yachts are set to be eclipsed three times with the Oceanco Y721 and Y719 and the Fedship Project 1010 all set to hit the water. In last year's Global Order Book, the Netherlands was ranked in second place with 74 projects. Our next Global Order Book is about to be released in the January issue, which we are currently all furiously working on. And we can reveal, though, that the Dutch fleet will remain in the same position. The number of projects ongoing are still the same, but the build length is getting longer. Don't miss the January issue for a full breakdown, of course, both the Dutch fleet, but also across the market.
Yeah, it's a great snapshot of the order book. And I can tell you the number will blow you away. There is a huge number of projects in build. The order book's grown by a quarter on last year's number. Just incredible. And it's the smaller semi-custom ranges that particularly have just blown up. So up 30.5 or something percent. So anyway, I don't want to give you too much detail because it's in the January issue and I have a pile of proofs on my desk to go through right now. But that's it for this week. Data and news. I hope you enjoyed that. Stay tuned for Charlotte's interview with Lisa Vibbitt from Bank of America.
So today I'm delighted to be joined by a lady called Lisa Vibbitt from Bank of America. She's the woman responsible for their yacht lending program within the Global Wealth and Investment Management Group. And in this capacity, her and her team work with new and existing clients on financings ranging in size from $1 million to $200 million, including both US and international build projects. She actually joined Bank of America back in 1984, so a pretty generous stint, and I'm sure she'll have plenty of words of wisdom for any owners listening to this podcast episode. Lisa, thank you for joining us.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me, Charlotte.
Where in the world are you? I'm aware we're in different time zones, and you're probably in the States somewhere, but whereabouts are you?
I'm in Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
Oh, fantastic. Great.
Just finished up the boat show, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you look refreshed from the boat show. I'll start with my first question then. I wondered if you could, rather than me introducing you badly, if you could say in your own words sort of what your role is and what type of work you do with yacht owners in particular.
So I'm in the yacht division with the wealth management group, as you made referenced in your opening comments. It's me and one other person on my team, Andrea McMillan, and we do all yachts all day, all the time. That's our role at the bank. So okay. We help existing clients with Merrill and the private bank with their yacht loan facilities. And we also sometimes, we bring in new business sometimes, so we work with prospective clients. And we also take on sort of a consultative approach. We are not yacht registration experts. We are not structuring experts. We are not tax experts. But given our years in the business, I'm 32 years in year 33 in the yacht business, and Andrea is in year 23 in the yacht business, all with this bank. So, and she's been with the bank something like 28 years. So we have, you know, a lot of depth in our group and a lot of not just in the bank, but in the yacht industry. So what we can do with clients sometimes is help them navigate the yacht buying process and yacht ownership process. Not that we give them specific recommendations about you should do this for your yacht structure, or you should definitely charter, or you should definitely think about this for, do this for tax purposes. But we can bring to the fore the things they need to be thinking about, and then we will refer them to industry professionals, maritime attorneys, brokers, charter agents, maritime insurance practitioners. You know, the yachting professionals in their specific area where they need the guidance to give them specific recommendations on how to proceed.
Fantastic. Well, we're going to talk about some of those things later on that you can sort of advise on. Sounds like you do an awful lot. But if we start at the beginning, largely from my point of view, because I know very little about yacht finance, I'm sure people listening will know slightly more than me. But if I was a potential new owner and I wanted to buy a yacht, what are the different options available to me in terms of financing it?
So our biggest competition, I'll start there. Our biggest competition is actually a client's cash or, you know, securities-based line of credit. So it's estimated that roughly, 40% of people finance the yacht using the yacht as collateral itself. You paying cash, obviously you have no interest expense there. Utilizing a securities-based line comes with a lower interest rate than a bona fide yacht deal. And then you can do a purchase money loan for a yacht where the bank takes the yacht as collateral. That's thankfully enough people do that. So I've had a really fun gig for going on 33 years. And the reasons people might finance using the yacht versus financing either paying cash or using their securities baseline, there's a couple reasons. Keeping liquidity free, whether it be in the nature of having cash on deposit that's free or availability under a line of credit that's open. So if you utilize either cash or your line of credit, you've diminished your ability, your liquid position, if you will. So clients are taking a look at their balance sheet composition and deciding, okay, how is the best way for me to utilize leverage, liquidity? And there's also the notion of financing a long-term asset with long-term debt. So there's that. And then finally, many clients, there's a positive arbitrage opportunity, right? They're earning more money on their income producing assets, whatever they may be, than the interest carry is on the yacht loan. So they'll take advantage of that, basically using our money, funding the yacht loan and keeping their liquidity free to make more money. Those are the reasons that people consider financing the yacht.
And say someone does come to you wanting a loan, what sort of things do you take into account when you're assessing what you're happy to lend and to whom?
So we look at the overall financial capacity of our clients. Key is ideally we'd like to see positive cash flow. We also look at how much liquidity the client has relative to their overall debt. We look at how levered a client is. So, ideally our repayment sources are cash flow first, liquidity second, and the yacht third or fourth. They could have some other unencumbered hard assets. As a practical matter, we're dealing with ultra high net worth individuals. So if they've sold a company, they may not have traditional cash flow. So in that case, we still lend to them. We just put in place loan covenants to protect our repayment source.
Right. Okay.
And then obviously we want credit to be good. The whole character part. Yes.
Yeah. So it sounds not that much different than a normal person buying a house or something, but presumably it is slightly different.
Yes. The credit components are all there, but you and I going out to buy a house, if we don't fit in the box, we're not getting our loan. If in the private wealth world, we are looking at, sometimes very sophisticated and sometimes complicated and not black and white balance sheets and cash flow, and we're able to put in place covenants to protect, say, a cash flow deficiency where cash flow is negative. When you go to get a mortgage for your house, you have to fit in their boxes. There's no loan covenants. So the mortgage business is highly regulated. The yacht business is not.
Yeah. Not so much. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There are a lot more regulations. We have, standard regulations we have to adhere to as a bank underwriting credit, but there's more leeway to be creative than there is in the mortgage business.
Yeah. I can imagine you get some particularly I can only imagine how complex some of these owners' finances are. It must be a bit of a nightmare unpicking it all.
Yeah.
But one of the questions I wanted to ask, especially thinking about, in recent years, and especially when I think back to, 2008, when there was the crash and so many shipyards went out of business, if we're kind of looking at worst case scenarios, say a yard goes bankrupt midway through the build or something and someone's got a loan from you, how does that all play out with you also being involved rather than just the straight relationship with the owner and the shipyard?
So we've, knock on wood, I think we've completed construction loans with shipyards I had, I counted it up several years ago, was over 30 shipyards around the world. And fortunately, we've just had about 3 shipyards that went into bankruptcy or receivership during the construction process. And what we do in those situations is work with the client to either finish the yacht at the yard in while it's in receivership, or some clients will choose to move their yacht to another yard to complete the yacht. But in every situation where we've had a shipyard go into bankruptcy while we had loans under construction, yachts under construction that we were financing there, we've finished the yacht in some fashion, either by working with the receiver and the client to complete the yacht in the bankrupt yard, or the client has moved the yacht to a different facility, a different shipbuilder to complete the yacht there. We did have one years ago that went under, and it was a we weren't very far into the process, and the client just bought the yard and paid us off. It's been a very rare occurrence for us in our experience.
Yeah. And listening to you talk about this, and earlier on in the podcast when you were talking about the different sort of services that you offer in terms of connections and things, I had kind of imagined you almost as a kind of silent partner just providing the funds, but it seems like you're fairly hands-on in terms of your involvement with the boat. Would you say that's fair, or is that kind of depending on a case by case?
So with construction loans, we are a partner in that there's some monitoring along the way. We're getting, you know, at each milestone payment, the client is presenting us a funding package that includes an inspection report, stage certificates, invoices, that represent that milestone has been met. So to that degree, yes, we're lockstep. And if a shipyard goes under and we have to work together, yes, we're communicating with the receiver, and the client's team to work through the process of finishing the yacht in a receivership situation. But we are definitely not partners in the truest sense of partner, because, it's the client's yacht and we made the loan based on the strength of the guarantor. It's not that collateral doesn't matter. Collateral absolutely matters. Otherwise, it'd be an unsecured loan. Our final repayment source is our guarantor. And then we just try to do what we need to do to protect the bank. And it just so happens that the clients and the bank's concerns are aligned, right? We both want a yacht that's completed on time. Well, it can be on time. There's usually construction delays, but we want to get the yacht out of there. So to that degree, then, we're in lockstep in trying to ensure that that we get a good product out on the other end and a completed product.
Because that was something else that I hadn't really thought of until we're having this conversation. But, presumably it must happen fairly often that people ask for a loan, and then as the bill drags on and the project develops, they're actually coming back to you and saying, oh, I'm going to need a bit more, we're going to need longer. So how does that work? Are you fairly flexible and used to kind of rolling with the project, as it were?
In the instance of, so say the completion date is, per the contract, is, 36 months. And we're doing a construction loan. We'll pad the construction phase. So, we have a construction period where the loan is interest only, and then we have a term phase where the yacht is delivered and then the loan starts amortizing. So we pad that construction phase. So on a 36-month build project, we'll pad it by, say, 6 months. So hopefully, because there invariably are construction delays driven by supply chain issues or, change orders or what have you. So we try to make it so we don't have to touch it too many times, because each time you're going to lawyers. So in normal times, that 6-month padding, let's say, tends to work. During COVID, because of all the restrictions placed around COVID and supply chain disruptions, we had projects that were more than a year past due. And so, yes, we work with the client. It's not their fault that the project is delayed. And so we just extend our construction period. When it comes to the build cost, clients, you know, clients can either ask, so generally we're around 70%. Clients can either ask for, you know, say, hey, my build is contract is $30 million, but I think I'm going to have about another $3 million in owner supplied items and things that are done outside the contract that are going towards the build project. So we can take the 30 and we can base the loan based on $33 million instead of the $30 million. So we've got room there to cover owner supplied items, and you know, then they've got those covered as well. Occasionally we have clients come back and ask for money because the project's overrun, but that's not the project overruns, but that's not the norm. They tend to just pay for them themselves. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. And one of the things I always find it quite funny, if you ask owners, you know, what would you advise anyone about to buy a yacht? They'll always just laugh and say, oh, don't do it. It's too expensive. The best day, the two best days are when you buy a boat and when you sell the boat. But, you know, from your perspective, what financial advice would you give to someone who is new to ownership and who hasn't decided, you know, they haven't even began to look into the different financing options and what they want to take on?
So, you know, this is a luxury lifestyle. Buying a yacht is a rather emotional purchase for a lot of people. And so I would say to, you know, yes, get caught up in the moment, but also sort of keep your business hat on, make sure you understand, you know, how much a yacht truly costs and be willing to hear, you know, things that may not, and accept, advice that may not coincide with your dream precisely. So to give you an example, you know, we've worked with clients over the years who, you know, bought a boat from one broker versus another broker because the one broker was giving them the true notion of how much it's going to cost to run this yacht and, you know, sort of the, yes, we want you to have your dream, but here are the realities, the practicalities that you should consider. And, you know, they went to the other broker who sold them just the dream. And, you know, I've had, you know, conversations over the years with clients who went for the dream, the guy who was selling them just the dream, but not being totally on the up and up on the, you know, the practicalities of yacht ownership and the expense of yacht ownership, and realized after the fact that they'd been sold a bill of goods. And that just leaves a bad taste in their mouth. And also, you know, their expectations were set improperly. So most of our clients, most of the clients we work with have grown up in yachting, right? So they've started at smaller yachts and you know, and grown into bigger and bigger yachts. So they have experience. That said, we do have clients new to the yachting world. And that's where, you know, we can have a discussion with them and say, listen, yes, you want the dream. Yes, this is an amazing thing. You've worked hard, but here are the practicalities. And here's from our perspective are, you know, what we see and what the numbers should look like. And
I'm always surprised. Yeah, it's not uncommon to hear owners say, oh, you know, I bought the boat, you know, the moment I stepped on foot, you know, I didn't do the due diligence. And you think that's insane. But I think for some people, you know, it's their retreat from business. So they don't like to think about it as another project, but it absolutely is. And you're right to counsel that. Now, I know that in addition to offering loans to buy yachts, you also offer loans against yachts. So can you talk a bit about how that works and what those clients are using that capital for, if you're able to generalize?
Yes. So, we do cash out financing where clients have paid cash or used their securities lines to pay for the yacht when they bought the yacht. And then a couple years later, a year later, they decide they need liquidity, and taking a yacht loan out, a cash out loan, is a way to free up liquidity. So we're more conservative on our advance rates on a cash out deal than we are in a purchase money deal, but we do offer them. So we've given clients lines of credit secured by their yacht, and they've used it to fund investments in real estate, or, you know, I did a loan earlier this year for a client. We cashed him out on his yacht, and he had purchased a home and was doing some renovations on it, and taking the equity out of the yacht was easier for him and made more sense to him than funding it a different way. So our proceeds are being used to fund the renovations of his new home. Some clients, we do revolvers where they fund up and down as they have business needs. So that, and actually we've done quite a number of cash outs in the current environment. And we tend to do those when rates are pretty low, and as they are now still. Yeah,
so maybe a good time to be doing it. And I want to ask you, you know, we hear a lot about how the yacht market is doing. You hear a different story, whether you're speaking to a broker or a builder or, you know, owners we know are loving it and buying more and more, but not everyone's obviously making money from that. What's your take on it, on the appetite for new and used yachts? And also, you know, given how you've seen things change in the time you've been working in this space.
Yeah, so our business has been very robust. We've already matched our best year ever, which was in 2016, and we'll exceed our best year. You know, this will become our new best year ever in 2021. So we've seen both an increase in dollar volume and an increase in the number of loans that we've put out. And we've had clients. I mean, I worked with a client earlier this year who was buying a yacht, and before he closed, it was in the 20 million range, I'll say. Before he closed, he was offered eventually 4 million more than he was paying for the yacht, and he didn't do it because he wanted the yacht, not the cash. And we've had clients who've lost opportunities to buy yachts because they didn't make a decision to move quick enough. And, you know, clients who said, this is my fourth yacht that I'm trying to buy. Hopefully I'm going to get this one. And we've had clients had to close sooner than, you know, we can accommodate the financing. So we've had clients have to pay cash, you know, because they have to close in 2 weeks, and it's not possible for us to get the financing in place in 2 weeks. So they've paid cash, and then we've cashed them out after the fact. So they could do a quick close and not lose the deal. We've also had clients sell their yachts. We're about to get paid off on a loan because the client, we just closed it this year, and he just got offered, I think it was $2 or $3 million more than he paid for it at the boat show. He's like, I can't turn that down. So, you know, it's values have been rising, and you know, what goes up does end up coming down. We'll see how and when that happens, you know, and to what degree. You know, we've got a really strong market. We have COVID driving people into yachting. You know, will some of those people get back out, you know, when we get on the other side of COVID, you know, to really more normalcy? And to what degree they will get out, you know, are some people, is it going to cause them to stay in because they realize they love yachting and they hadn't pulled the plug before because they pulled the trigger, I guess, because, you know, of the cost, but then COVID, and I want to be safe. I want to travel with my family. And then also, you know, sort of this seize the day moment, you know, like, hey, I've worked hard and things like COVID happen and, you know, that are pretty terrible. And so maybe I should go ahead and, you know, enjoy my life.
I think it's interesting what you're saying about kind of the market moving faster than maybe it normally would over COVID, and people kind of making decisions a lot quicker to secure the yachts that they really want, or likewise, you know, people are being offered stuff that they weren't necessarily sort of putting the yachts up for sale. How long do you need? Say I'm an ambitious owner with a really complicated plan for a new explorer yacht that's going to need loads of cash. How long do you need to kind of assess that and make a decision and give me an answer?
Our our average underwriting time is a month to underwriting to close. A month would be short in today's environment. And then 6 weeks, you know, for a sort of a typical loan that's not overly complicated, is, you know, probably so 4 to 6 weeks in total, but probably more likely on the 6 week time frame in this current environment. And then if they're like, you know, if we do a loan for $100 million, that's probably going to take longer to put in place. There's going to be a lot of give and take and conversation and going back and forth with financial information. But one of the key drivers for our ability to deliver a response efficiently and more timely is getting the information up front. You know, we'll provide a list of information, and if it's trickled in, then it's going to delay the process. If we get everything we ask for up front, then that's going to make the process that much more efficient and timely.
So you touched on it earlier. You were saying lots of the people that have loans with you have kind of grown up in yachting and have progressed from smaller boats to bigger boats. Have you seen a lot of sort of new first-time owners, first-time buyers as a result of COVID, kind of people coming to you?
Yes, yes. Yacht ownership for the first time at our level, you know, where it's financeable by us. Yeah, yeah. Many people are involved in smaller and boating, you know, for their whole lives. And then, you know, they take their plunge, you know, for the first time. COVID has driven some people to do that. You know, we had a client that we financed last year. And he and his wife had been charter clients for 12 years. They'd owned small boats, but they chartered for 12 years and their life changed. Their kids were all grown. They were in college. I mean, they were out of college, had their own families. And so, you know, they'd been chartering large yachts. They hadn't owned large yachts, but, you know, we did a $12 million loan for a client who had chartered, you know, they chartered for 12 years and then decided, you know, we're going to jump in. And now that our circumstances have changed in our family, we want to be able to travel the world and we'd like to own now. So, you know, so they're first time large yacht owners, but they're not new to the yachting business per se. So they had already been involved in chartering. So they knew, you know, they had an idea of what the costs were, the expenses were because of, by virtue of the fact that they had been chartering yachts. So they were new to the yacht industry, but they, you know, they had some familiarity with the cost. Once in a while, we've had, even before COVID, we have clients who've owned, you know, runabouts or whatever, and then they come into a liquidity event and their first yacht is $30 million. and, you know, those clients typically do bring in a whole host of advisors and listen to them and have a true sense of what it's going to cost to maintain the yacht. So, you know, even though they're a first-time buyer, they have, many of those clients at that level, for example, have done their homework.
And how has all this new demand affected the yacht values then, as you can see it?
We've seen yacht values going up. Based on surveys we're getting, because, you know, we have renewals sometimes too. So when we have renewals, we get a new survey. So, you know, we can see where values have gone up there. We can see where values have gone up, you know, when we do a cash out deal. We can see where values have gone up, even just, you know, giving the examples earlier of clients who've been offered, you know, $2, $3, $4, $5 million more before they've even closed on the yacht they're trying to buy. We've had clients lose, you know, because they didn't move fast enough, or get outbid because they didn't move fast enough. We've had clients who got outbid and then the larger offer was accepted, not only because it was a bigger offer, but because the second offer was, the buyer was willing to close without a survey on the yacht. And our client was like, no, we're not. That's crazy. I'm not buying it, you know, a multi-million dollar asset without getting a survey. But, you know, those are the calculations that people make. And some people are, you know, comfortable with those calculations and others are more conservative.
Thank you so much. You've given us so much kind of great advice here, and I'm sure this would be a really useful starting point for anyone listening. But what's the best way of following up with you or learning a bit more? You mentioned liquidity days or liquidity events, but can people contact you personally? Is your department the best place to go? How can people follow up?
So people may contact me personally, to the degree, or Andrea McMillan, but they, many clients come to us through their advisors also. So if they have an existing Merrill relationship or an existing private bank relationship, we're always brought into the mix. We're always part of the team if there's a yacht deal. So, you know, they can access us any way that feels comfortable to them. If they come to us first, we're going to ask them, hey, do you bank with Merrill or the private bank? And if the answer is yes, then we're going to work with that, with their Merrill or private bank team. So whatever is comfortable for them.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I'm going to ask you one final question, which is a sneaky one. But from what you've seen, because you've obviously seen mostly very happy new yacht owners and I guess some not so happy, would you buy a super yacht?
Would I, if I had the money?
Yeah.
Probably. Yeah.
Yeah. I let you say that quite casual. Yeah, maybe I will.
I probably would. Yeah. If it was between a yacht and a plane, it might be, you know, because you can charter planes too. So I don't know. Yeah. But no, yacht ownership definitely has its appeal. I definitely understand the appeal of yacht ownership.
Okay. Well, that's good news. You haven't seen too many yacht owners go wrong. Thank you so much for your time, Lisa. Really great to meet you. And I feel like I understand a lot more. Thank you.
You too. Thanks, Charlotte.
Thanks for listening to this week's Boat Briefing, which was mixed and produced by Grace Nielsen and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you next week.